Hi everyone, welcome to the Alago 15th Annual Summit. We're just gonna give a couple minutes and let everyone into the room and then we'll get started.
And hi Darcy, go ahead and follow Darcy's lead and feel free to introduce yourself and say where you work. Some of you joined us earlier this week and some of you may just be joining us today. So. Go for it.
So nice to see so many familiar names popping up today. Welcome. And I'll just give it one more minute and then we'll go ahead and get started. Right, so we're at the 3 minute mark. Hello everyone, my name is Amy Stanforth. I'm the current chair of ILAGO, the Information Literacy Advocacy Group of Oregon. This is our 15th annual summit here in 2021. Thank you all so much for joining us. We're excited to have three presentations today. I have an agenda for us. So we'll start our session today with a land acknowledgement. Then we'll hear from our three presenters. First, we'll have Anders Tobiasen presenting on developing information literate abilities and uncovering whiteness at the center of the ACRL framework for information literacy. Then we'll have Linda Irons presenting about transparent teaching in action and developing a first year seminar lesson plan. And then finally, we'll have Don Lowe Winchinson and Ala Powers, I almost wanted to say it in a Spanish way, but Ala Powers presenting on an adaptive open information literacy model for the sciences. So during our presentations, I'll ask you all to keep your microphones muted. If you would like to keep your cameras off, please do so. And if you have questions for our presenters, please place those questions into the chat box. And then at the end of the presentations, at the end of all three, we'll go ahead and ask the questions to our presenters. So remember, we do have three presentations. So please indicate in the chat who your question is for. And so to get us started, I'd like to do a land acknowledgement for you all. I currently work at Portland State University. It's located in the heart of downtown Portland, Oregon in Multnomah County. We honor the indigenous people whose traditional and ancestral homelands we stand on, the Multnomah, Cathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, Watlala bands of the Chinook, the Tualatin, Kalapuyeh, and many other indigenous nations of the Columbia River. It's important to acknowledge the ancestors of this place and to recognize that we are here because of the sacrifices forced upon them. In remembering these communities, we honor their legacy, their lives, and their descendants. So this land acknowledgement is coming to you from the Native American Student and Community Center. And I'm doing this one today because I live in Portland, Oregon, but I do encourage you all to explore the link native-land.ca to learn more about the communities and the people that were in your homelands where you're at today too. So at this point in time, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Anders, our first presenter. And here's where I try to find my button. Great. So I'll go ahead and stop sharing my screen. And Anders, please take it away.
Okay, and I'm just gonna have Bronwyn drop the slides in the chat, and then I will start sharing.
Thank you.
Let me get this shared screen going. Okay, all right. So as Amy said, I'm gonna talk on developing information literate abilities, uncovering whiteness at the center of the ACRL framework for information literacy. I'm gonna start with a short excerpt from a spoken word piece called Three Ways to Speak English by Jamila Liascott. It's worth watching the whole thing, but I'm just gonna play an excerpt.
And friends, I'm a trilingual orator. Sometimes I'm consistent with my language now to switch it up so I don't bore later. Sometimes I fight back two tongues while I use the other one in the classroom. And when I mistakenly mix them up, I feel crazy like I'm cooking in the bathroom. I know that I had to borrow your language because mine was stolen. But you can't expect me to speak your history wholly while mine is broken. These words are spoken by someone who is simply fed up with the Eurocentric ideals of this season. And the reason I speak a composite version of your language is because mine was raped away along with my history. I speak broken English so the profuse and gashes can remind us that our current state is not a mystery. I'm so tired.
We'll return to the importance of this poem later. But for now, keep in mind the idea of speaking broken English and a celebration of being trilingual. Let me set up my critical lens. This project utilizes a number of different critical frames and tools. The first of these tools is from discussions of white institutional presence. D.L. Gusser writes that, quote, WIP focuses on white normative messages and practices that are exchanged within the academic milieu. When these messages and practices remain subtle, nebulous, and unnamed, they potentially harm the well-being, self-esteem, and academic success of those who do not share the norms of white culture, end quote. As we shall see, the white normative messages in the framework are certainly unnamed, but they are not nearly as nebulous as we might think. They operate in a way that presumes a white gaze as normative and white privilege in terms of information access and control. The theory of WIP helps us see the way in which information literacy in the framework is coded fundamentally white, in the way it emphasizes the individual, the unexamined power relationship of learning to speak in a language that has been used to oppress, and assumes a learner in complete control over their own interactions with the information environment. I also draw on anti-racist black language in education and pedagogy. This pedagogical stance was created by April Baker Bell. She writes that it, quote, provides black students with critical literacies and competencies to name, investigate, and dismantle white linguistic hegemony and anti-black linguistic racism, end quote. Her work highlights how asking black language speakers to code switch in order to succeed and punishing them for not switching to white mainstream English causes real harm, not only to their language, but to their very sense of self. As their language is devalued, so are they. And finally, I draw on whiteness and critical discourse analysis using concepts drawn from Faith Yacoubian's 2020 dissertation. She writes that, quote, the concepts of mastery and authority in the academy reverberate a colonial episteme of domination by assuming that encounters with the world should convert to information that humans consume, more like devour, master. Consuming information is not enough, though. We must dissect it, slowly swallow parts of it, and stretch our stomachs to eat all of it, analogous to educational competency criteria, end quote. One cannot help but see the parallels between this critique and the language of the framework. Becoming information literate, in other words, requires one to become a master, whether one's relationship with the world is that way or not. Yacoubian's work is particularly helpful in uncovering the ways in which whiteness works in the academy. She writes that, quote, objectivity, the concept of concerted mastery and autonomy are leading canons of whiteness, reinforced by ideas of individuality and privatization or proprietorship, end quote. And goes even further to remind us that, quote, the double standard that requires racially and ethnically marginalized persons to assimilate into white culture in order to be heard, but does not require white culture to acclimate to these same persons' cultures, vindicates white culture of the harm it causes by making being listened to conditional. It also absolves white culture of its role in causing racially and ethnically marginalized persons to perceive themselves as inferior without looking to the double standard as the source of that perception, end quote. Anyone sensing a pattern? So that's where I'm coming from a critical perspective that looks at the ways in which whiteness underlies institutions, educational practices, and finally, the academy itself. Let's look at a definition of whiteness. I'm not going to read out the whole thing. The key points are that it's a socially and politically constructed behavior and represents a position of power where the power holder defines social categories and reality, the master narrator. In addition, whiteness is often unnamed. We do not name it white American culture because to do so would be show the moniker white would be a marker of difference on par with other races. That's not how whiteness works. It lies at the background, at a level where most folks operating under its sphere cannot recognize it, especially when it benefits them. As many scholars have argued for over 20 years, including Eduardo Bonilla Silva, Kimberly Crenshaw, David Theo Goldberg, and many others, race-neutral policies and practices, thus, can be seen as embodiments of whiteness's function as a neutral background. If you do not see race, then you do not need to investigate how whiteness works. There is no whiteness. Ian Beelan writes of the framework that, quote, teaching students how to function within an academic discourse can be perilously close to teaching students how to conform, how to get along, how to succeed, end quote. We can see echoes here of Baker Bell's critique of anti-Black language instruction in that both pedagogies and the framework is a pedagogy. Teach students to code switch in order to succeed in a world that does not recognize their ways of knowing and being. And as Ruha Benjamin reminds us in Race After Technology, quote, the practice of code switching is power laden. In terms of race and the framework, Marcia Rapchuk's vital statement stands out. She writes that, quote, we cannot fully examine the information environment without understanding how it is impacted by the structural oppression of people of color, especially at the intersection of other identities. Since the framework names some of these other identities, it's peculiar that it does not include race, end quote. I'm arguing here that actually the absence of an explicit naming of race is not so surprising. The absence of a mention of race as a category allows whiteness to disappear and be viewed as neutral. It also creates a situation in which the ideal information literate individual is raceless, is, in other words, white. So let's see some of the ways whiteness operates at the core of the framework. Let's start with the very idea of developing information literate abilities. It implies that all relationships to information, not mentioned in the behaviors, are illiterate. It can also be a tool to oppress those who do not conform to the dominant standard of information as commodity and literacy as mastery as defined in the framework. As Josh Beattie states, quote, I believe that relative to its overall place within the library, information literacy is of outsized importance as a potential tool of oppression. Information literacy does not merely target the contents of the mind, but consciously tries to change individuals' cognitive processes, end quote. So to become information literate is to change one's cognitive processes, and more specifically, to change one's cognitive processes to fit the dominant culture of the individual master of information. Literacy itself has long been a tool of oppression as colonial powers used it as a means of control over native cultures. April Baker Bell again has important wisdom to impart here, quote, any instruction that emphasizes the importance of white mainstream English over all other linguistic forms is especially dangerous for Black students and other linguistically marginalized students of color, as it communicates to them that being Black and speaking in Black language are insufficient, end quote. The very language of becoming information literate makes this kind of deficit thinking explicit. In other words, it's saying that here are the tools to become information literate, as long as information literate is defined as individual mastery within the defined frame of the academy and white mainstream English. Any other relationship, any kind of collective or alternative way of understanding the relationship between information and society, is therefore deemed illiterate. So let's get down into the weeds, as it were, or down to the bones. Yacoubian writes that, quote, Western values, principled in human capital and economic proliferation, seed education in a plot that is fertilized by power, which when directed towards domination breeds oppression. This is most prominently evidenced in U.S. education, in which an unspoken archetype of student against which all other students are measured, exists, and from which outliers are made discernible and discardable, end quote. For our purposes here, the question must be, what is the model information literate individual? What is the archetype? Who is discarded? The first frame I want to take a look at is scholarship as conversation. Let's start with the final disposition. Information literate individuals, quote, recognize that systems privilege authorities and that not having a fluency in the language and processes of a discipline disempowers their ability to participate and engage, end quote. Does it though? Does not having a fluency in the language of whiteness or the implicit ways whiteness frames scholarship as objective and neutral disempower someone? Or perhaps it is in fact a good thing to not be fluent in that language, to imagine multiple ways of knowing. And this is where code switching and its highly destructive power come in. We will get to the problem of the term authority in a bit, but let's focus here on language fluency. The frame, in multiple ways, the most explicitly here, tells anyone not steeped in the seemingly neutral language of a discipline, or in general, the unexamined normalness of white mainstream English, that their engagement with the discipline or the wider world is without power in it. In this way, it lies directly in line with the kinds of anti-Black language teaching practices that Baker Bell and others theorize as harmful to not only Black language and thought, but literally to Black lives. In talking about what code switching actually does, she writes that, quote, they are being asked to switch their language, their cultural ways of being and knowing, their community, and their Blackness in favor of a white middle-class identity, end quote. So in order to become fluent, to gain power in terms of entering a conversation, this frame asks folks to discard their Blackness, discard their otherness, in other words, to become white. This kind of invocation of a standard language and language unexamined in its relationship to racial oppression sits at the heart of white institutional presence. While the framework skirts around the issue of a standard, it was meant to replace standards, after all, there is nonetheless an emphasis on knowledge as that produced by and within rather traditional means. It's not to say that understanding these things is not important. It most definitively is. But by not mentioning race, by not making explicit who's been excluded from the ability to make contributions, it creates a situation where disciplinary knowledge is deemed as neutral. Indeed, the problems of context and neutrality plague the framework more generally. By this, I mean that process of entering into conversations is portrayed as neutral. The process of searching is portrayed as neutral. Even the frame information has value assumes a kind of neutral actor and complete control of how they choose to distribute their personal information. That frame is particularly problematic. These points illustrate this issue. Information literate individuals, one, understand how and why some individuals or groups of individuals may be underrepresented or systematically marginalized within the systems that produce and disseminate information. Two, decide where and how their information is published. Three, understand how the commodification of their personal information and online interactions affects the information they receive and the information they produce or disseminate online. And four, make informed choices regarding their online actions in full awareness of issues related to privacy and the commodification of personal information. Each of these knowledge practices assumes that the individual is in complete control of their personal information. For surveilled groups, which is most BIPOC communities in the United States, this complete control is literally unachievable. In fact, the information gathered against one's will is often used against these communities. And even more problematic is the idea of understanding how and why some groups are underrepresented without addressing ways to change this. We can see this as a manifestation of white privilege in that the question is not, why is white thought centered in the discourse? That's unremarked on. But rather, why are other groups underrepresented? And just to understand how and why is not good enough. Because what if that group is you? Are you merely asked to understand and accept this understanding of your marginalized presence? Remember the poem at the beginning of the talk? While the language is borrowed and used, it nonetheless has traces of that which was stolen. But what if the purpose of being asked to code switch, to merely understand your institutional marginalization, is to try to make that trace disappear? What if we were to imagine a kind of information literacy that disregarded the individual authority for the collective, which allowed the trace of stolen languages to flourish? Where might that lead us? It certainly would lead us away from the kind of authority talked about and framed as normative in the authority is constructed and contextual frame. This is where the unnaming of race that Rapchik so rightly criticizes comes in. It's also the place where authority is enshrined as being something an individual possesses, or is granted, or a work is granted. Authority, in other words, is not shared. The paragraph description of the authority frame contains within it this sentence, quote, Experts understand the need to determine the validity of the information created by different authorities and to acknowledge biases that privilege some sources of authority over others, especially in terms of others' worldview, gender, sexual orientation, and cultural orientations, end quote. This is where race is conspicuously absent, as Rapchik points out, but there's something else going on here as well. The concept of authority, the very word itself, is problematic. To become an authority, one must uncritically embrace the idea that a singular authority should exist. This is a hallmark of WIP, as described by Gusa thusly, quote, finally, within an objective, rational classroom environment, emphasis is placed on the hierarchical teaching of the knower, the expert professor who, or the authoritative text that, disregards or diminishes student experiences. This is further problematized when we historicize the idea of authority and ask what the power relationship between novice and expert is. This power relation, historically, has been leveraged to ensure that only certain kinds of people can become authorities or experts. And while the frame nods towards this, it still presents this fact as neutral, as just something that is, not something that needs to or should be resisted. One of the main features of whiteness is the idea of it as a neutral background in our society. And in the discussion of authority, we can see this in the idea that the marginalization of certain groups is meant to be merely understood rather than challenged. There are no overt displays of racism in the framework. In fact, it's at pains to paint itself as multicultural, as race neutral. But as we know, race neutral is anything but. By not grappling with the ways in which whiteness remains the dominant frame of the academy, and by utilizing the language of domination and authority, and the framework aligns itself nicely with a worldview that suggests that the model information literate individual is raceless. In other words, white. What if we were to conceive of our relationship to information as complementary, not as novice and expert, not as authority, not as gained or in need of gaining? Might we then imagine authority as something each of us already has? Let's more than celebrate the trilingual. Let's center it, revel in it, aspire to become it, rather than the other way around. Thank you very much. And I've created a slide deck, and at the end of that slide deck, there is also a bibliography. I'm gonna end.
Thank you so much, Anders. That was a great presentation, and there's been a lot of really fruitful discussion in the chat. I'd like to remind everyone that if you have questions for Anders or any of our presenters, please place them in the chat and make sure that you indicate who your questions are for. And with that, I'll let Linda take it over. Thank you, Linda.
Thank you. Okay, nod ahead so we can see the slide deck. I'm not sure if I can follow that, Anders. Thank you for that. Hello, my name is Linda Irons, and welcome to this short presentation on what transparent teaching in action is. My goal is that by applying the transparent teaching principles, we can help students have a greater academic success. A caveat, I am not an expert in transparent teaching, but I know it is a thing, and I know that this thing can help students help students better. I would like to draw your attention to Garrett Trott on Tuesday gave a fantastic presentation on transparent teaching as well. So if you get a chance, I hope that you watch his presentation. So I'll explain what the principles are and what they mean. You'll learn the difference between a purpose and the task, and you'll hear the importance of what constitutes success, all peppered with real world examples. There are numerous resources available on transparent teaching and developing rubric. There are two, and their citations are in the resource slide. I also encourage you to explore the TILT site. It is full of useful information ranging from video articles to sample assignments. I first became aware of the concept of transparent teaching at a workshop sponsored by Pacific University's Center for Educational Technology and Curricular Innovation. Then I also participated in a workshop on transparent teaching. I would like to credit the workshop instructor, Melissa Bowles-Terry, Associate Director for the Faculty Center at the University of Las Vegas, for some of the information in this presentation and used with permission. So workshop participants were had to create an artifact such as a lesson plan, either for a course or for a particular session. Here is mine. I'm trying to put in the kitchen sink here. I do admit the lesson plan was reverse engineered. I have a confession to make. I've been teaching for a very long time and I don't often, i.e. never, create lesson plans. So as a result, I literally had to start from scratch, relying on experience and memory, and we had to create the lesson plan with the transparency in teaching lens. I will be developing more lesson plans with other learning objectives and learning and other courses down the road as well. So what is transparent teaching? It's mainly about the why. This is what the student is thinking. Why do I have to sit through the librarian's presentation? Why am I in the library in the first place? Why do I need a scholarly article, or for that matter, what one is anyway? or a book or a documentary? Why do I need to know any of this stuff? Because it isn't everything on Google anyway. And I can certainly get what I need from my textbook, my teacher, my classmates, my friends. The idea is that we help helping them understand the why and the how and the what. I think we've all heard from students say they didn't understand why they got the grade they got, or they felt they needed to be mind readers to get what their teacher wanted. Transparency clears the fog, and this is how. Really basic. Explain the why you're having them do something, have them do it, and then show them what success looks like. That's it. So I think this is all we are doing this anyway, but it's nice to have a name to our actions. Studies have shown that students do better when transparent teaching methods are applied. So this is what students typically get, and this is actually what they really need. They really need to know the why. So let's talk about those principles. Principle number one is purpose. One of the biggest eye-opening discoveries was learning the difference between purpose and task. In transparent teaching, they have different meanings and different roles. Purpose is the biggest why of them all, or that what for question. Google defines purposes as the reason something is done or the aim or intention of something. If we're going to ask the students to do something, knowing the purpose or the why is important for student buy-in. Think to situations you've encountered when you've been asked to do something and you didn't know why or for what purpose. Having that information may not want you to like or do that thing anymore, but at least you have a clearer understanding on it. To continue with this idea of purpose, it's helped students understand why this is relevant to them and why they want to use it. For example, the library will save you money, or that your boss has expected you to keep current on the latest information, or you need to know this for the test or paper to write, or you need to know this for school. Just some examples. When developing your lesson plan, whether it's formalized or otherwise, there are some questions you can ask yourself. Please note that number six is, I think, critical. Purpose is not the task. The task is something like this. Use the Avon database to use a documentary on poverty with the release date of 2018 or later. So that's the task. So what would be the purpose? Why would you use a documentary? Why would you search for a documentary in the first place? That would be the purpose. If you think about it, Andrew's presentation notwithstanding, the ACR frameworks are purposes. For in developing the lesson plan for the first year seminar, I thought of two purposes or two frameworks. First is the searching as a strategic exploration, in that searching identifies relevant resources and how to access them. The second framework could be scholarship as conversation, and the idea that communities talk to one another over time. So actually both served my purposes when I was creating the lesson plan for FYS. So talk a little bit about what FYS is and who it's for. This is a course that incoming students take in their fall of their first year. There are approximately 22 sections. I teach in 20 of the 22 for about 375 students. It varies, but I do have each section. I do meet with the students one time for approximately 65 minutes. And believe me, that is a luxury. FYS is taught by the faculty in the College of Arts and Sciences, and they have autonomy in their course content so long as they're meeting the goals and objectives of FYS. So I do meet with the faculty members to get a sense of what they want from their students to be able to learn from that session. It can range for something very specific or to the idea of here's how the libraries and what they work. So let's look at this from the student's perspective. Why are they here in the classroom that we have in the library, or I visit them in their classroom? So why are they even here? So what's their purpose? So part of the purposes are definitely associated with learning outcomes and working in collaboration with the faculty. So say, for example, they and I wanted them to have an understanding that information comes in all shapes and sizes, including but not limited to books, DVDs, articles, then I could have a purpose as why libraries? Why is in the first place? They have an information need, libraries have it, can lead you to it, and librarians know stuff. This is actual slide I actually do use for my first our class. I try to emphasize the importance of saving time and money. Then I next go on to explain how, as a purpose, is the library is akin to sites. I try to connection between what they already know, how to use shopping sites a la Amazon, and how to apply that idea and concepts, that prior knowledge, to searching libraries. To reinforce, they're not doing anything that they haven't already know how to, already know they already are doing. Then I go into purpose number two. If I and the professor really wants the student to focus on scholarly articles, then of course you have to explain what they are and why they're important on that. So those are just examples of some purposes as to the why the student is sitting in the library classroom and why I'm talking to them. Let's go on to the next criteria, the next principle, and that is task. Merriam-Webster defines task as usually a series of work to be finished within a certain time. So the task is actually what they will do on their computers, on paper, in groups, in front of the class, et cetera. So if the task is to locate a scholarly peer-reviewed article topic, how do you know that they did it? So it helps me to think in action verbs such as search, provide, limit, et cetera. So when you're thinking of your task, this, what this is actually going to be doing in relation to the purpose, think of these sort of questions. Again, what sort of skills are they picking up? How can they apply knowledge, et cetera. So for my purposes, the students are going to be applying their shopping skills to enter keywords. They're going to evaluate and they're going to obtain. And then we do this by modeling. You know, I model a search strategy with a keyword that I particularly will use. If the task, again, is to locate a scholarly peer-reviewed article, then they need to know what one looks like. So I provide them with, these are little handouts that the students do receive in class. And so they have an idea. We talk about the characteristics and we talk about what one looks like. And if I have an opportunity or time, they actually handle journals and magazines in the class. If the task is to enter keywords, they need to know what they are. So we spend some time on talking about nouns and how they can enter those into the search strategy. If the task is to use a search engine, they need to know what that is. So again, akin to a shopping site, we actually work our way through our library catalog or search box. I'm leaning more towards search box than catalog or either branded name of box search. So again, continuing with the metaphor of shopping metaphor, we're all Amazon shoppers. Then of course I show them how to limit to peer-reviewed journals after we talked about what they are and how to use the search box to use them. And then sometimes I actually turn them loose and they discover for themselves that this exists rather than my telling them. And then after that, I use a different sort of metaphor. I pop the hood so we can take the task of evaluation and how to get their hands on the site, the source itself. Now let's move on to that third principle of criteria. Criteria, I think, is the hardest one for the students. So I know it's hardest for me because what is in my head, I don't always communicate to the student. So expectations aren't always clearly defined, but they need to know in advance what success looks like. For me, again, how do we know that we have, how to get it, et cetera. On that. So again, reflect on your learning outcomes. For me in the class, again, we talked about what one looks like. If I see either on their screen or if they uploaded something to a Google Doc or they provided me with the link to the resource, then I consider that a success. They know what I'm looking for. And if I see evidence that they found something that is relevant or close enough to their topic, then I can consider that a success. I also do other assessments like we all do. I check in with them within the class frequently at multiple times. I also do a poll everywhere. And then I may ask them or have them fill out a paper comment card. What is it you learned in class today that you didn't know before you came? Now, lastly, there are these ideas of rubrics, and I have to admit, I've never developed a rubric to this degree before, but I think it is something I'm going to definitely start doing because I need to be able to clearly articulate what success looks like. And again, providing this to the student beforehand is helpful to them. So in conclusion, transparent teaching is basically managing expectations let the student be aware what is going to be expected of them, explaining why they're sitting in that seat in the library classroom, why I'm having them look for scholarly articles and using that particular tool, and then show them what success looks like. And here is the reference list to those two sources I cited earlier, and thank you. Let me stop share. Okay.
Thank you so much, Linda. Thank you for that presentation and for sharing all of that with us. Our final presentation is going to be Dawn and Ala. I'll go ahead and let you share screen now and whenever you're ready.
Okay. I hope you're actually seeing the screen right now.
We are.
Okay, great. So I'm Dawn Lowen-Sensen. Ala, can you speak so that they know who you are and see you?
And hello, I'm Ala Powers. Hello from Klamath Falls.
We are two of the librarians at Oregon Institute of Technology. You're going to see a little bit of overlap with what we did and what Linda was talking about. And if you went to the Tuesday presentations, what Garrett was talking about there, because we all went to the same workshops in the fall. And it's really cool that we're all working on these projects that kind of overlap and coalesce and bring what we learned out into the environment. So the history of the project that we worked on, there is an online learning advisory council. This is run by our distance education department. And in the fall, they contacted myself, John Schobert, the university librarian, and maybe all of the librarians, and said, hey, how's this embedded librarian project going? So back in 2013, Oregon Tech Library started an embedded librarian project where we had librarians attached to online courses. You may, if you're familiar with some of the work Ilago has done and have been at previous presentations, Asia Betancourt McCarthy, Carrie Dixon, and myself presented on this very program in 2015, I think it was. So we had this embedded librarian program, and the Online Learning Advisory Council asked us how it was going. And it wasn't. There was nobody involved in it. We had no librarians attached to any courses in fall of 2020 when everything was remote and had an online course that we should have been attached to. So we identified a problem. And when we talked to the advisory council, what we learned was that there was a desire to have something ready-made, something that they could plug and play into the courses that they had. And that there was a desire to have different assignment levels. So if you're teaching a 100 writing class, you might want something a bit different than if you're teaching a 400 level business class. So what we built works on those different levels.
So what is transparency? As Dawn mentioned, she and I took a workshop last October in transparent design in learning and teaching, TILT methodology. The book that we're citing on this slide talks about TILT, but mostly for non-library instruction. Marianne Winkelmans, who is mentioned here as one of the editors, is the founder of TILT. Transparent instruction design is an important method of ensuring that students who are unfamiliar with traditional structure and culture of higher education, such as first generation students, minorities, have the same understanding of academic experience, what's expected of them, as do all other students. Transparent design calls for instructors to explicitly discuss with students the purpose of an assignment or an activity, and also explain how student success will be measured. The fall workshop that we attended sought to do just that, to translate this principle of transparent design to academic library instruction.
One of the unique things that we did with this was we used open educational resources. So some of you might be familiar, and this is going to be a little bit of a recap on what those are. An open educational resource in the context that we're using is a material that is reusable, can be remixed, so you can make it with multiple different OERs. You can redistribute it in a variety of modes. You can revise it and you can keep it. So each of the modules that we created links out to a piece of an OER out there in the world. And everything that we've done and everything that we've used has some sort of creative license or sharing ability with it.
Six pillars of information literacy. So our adaptable course, course module rather, for Oregon Tech faculty used six pillars of information literacy as described in the Informational Literacy User's Guide. The URL is here on the slide, an open online resource, and also SCONAHL, which is Society of College, National and University Libraries in the UK. I think of these pillars as steps in a research process that we want every student to go through. We divided the IL pillars among themselves and created adaptable modules for each one of them based on the transparent design principle. So for each pillar, we suggested purpose, which includes knowledge to be gained and skills to be developed, tasks, and criteria for success. We came up with examples of exercises and evaluation criteria to be adapted by the faculty for their classes for each level that Dawn mentioned.
So here's the three levels of assignments. This language ties directly back to the essential learning outcomes language that Oregon Tech uses in our accreditation process. So this helps people to attach what they are doing to the outcomes that we are supposed to be meeting to meet accreditation and that we're supposed to be evaluating on. Foundation is 100 to 200 level, practicing is a 200 to 300 level, and advanced is 400 and above. And then at least one of the modules has some bonus content in it. One thing I want to mention based on what Ala was just saying is the next few slides go through what the course looks like. I am currently using material that I have adapted from what Ala and I built in LIS 305, which is a research strategies class. And one of the students in that class said that the course is so well designed, it makes it easy to do the work. So not that the work is easy, but because of the transparent design and because everything is built in there with easily accessible materials, it's easy to do the work that they have to do. So here is what it looks like. We built this in Canvas, which is what Oregon Tech uses, and we have made it available with a Creative Commons license in the Canvas Commons. So what you're seeing is what that looks like directly to the Oregon Tech community, but there is also a public version that you can go into the Canvas Commons and get even if you don't have a institutional license to Canvas. We do have a video walkthrough. I'm going to go through a couple of the slides through that. This walkthrough is about 5 minutes long, so we're not going to play it today. What you're seeing in the background here is the layout of what the course looks like or what the module looks like if you start to embed it. At the top, we have a how to use this module for instructors. So it goes through the different pieces that are available. And it tells them a little bit about that information and how they might want to use it. And as we scroll down, you can see in each section that we have a purpose, we have an introduction, we have the skills, we have reading, and then at the bottom, you can see the foundation practicing and advanced different assignments that they might be able to access. The next piece of that is an introduction to information literacy for students. And again, this is using the SCONAHL information literacy pillars along with a information literacy OER published through SUNY. We don't talk directly about ACRL or the ACRL information literacy framework, which is another unique aspect of what we were doing. This introduction looks at an overview of information literacy. And then here's what that looks like as you scroll down. And each one of these tabs has the same layout of information. It's easy to access that information and see what's going on. They have different videos that we have either created or found that explain this. And then this is an example of one of the assignments. So in this assignment, it is a practicing level, so 200 to 300 level, and it's Google versus the library. And it tells students that the internet is an easy button. You give a little introduction that ties back to an experience that they might have, recognizing the language that we're using is language that students would be using, not too much jargon involved in it. It talks about the purpose, like why is your professor going to ask you to do the same search in Google and then through library resources? It's a comparison to see what works best, the skills, and then the tasks that you would go through, and it provides a criteria. Some of the criteria we got very into detail as a step-by-step numerical values. Some of them are a couple of sentences so that the professor that embeds this into their class can adapt it to the point system that they have. When I embedded this into my own class, I gave everything except for the final a 50-point structure and evened it out. There's a lot of assignments that I did end up embedding into that course where I gave you the quote from the student. And then here is all NI's contact information.
Thank you. Sorry, I was answering a chat question during the end of that. Thank you so much for sharing with us your course using transparent design principles. I was really focused on reading that criteria at the bottom because like Linda, I find that to be kind of like the most complicated part to create for myself and something that I personally struggle with. So now that we've heard from all three of our presenters, if you have questions, please place them in the chat. Additionally, if you feel like you have a comment and you would like to turn your camera on and your audio as well, and you would like to speak, please do so. Remember, the session's being recorded, so keep that in mind. At the moment, we don't have any questions in the chat, so I'll just leave some space here for those thoughts to come to light and populate.
I have a question, still kind of forming it, so, and it may not make sense, but I use the five steps of the research process, which is not a thing. I say it like it's a thing, but it's not a thing to my knowledge other than outside of this guide that I just linked to. So a research question, finding background information, finding materials, reading and evaluating and organize, write and cite. That's a model that a friend of mine and I took from 8 steps down to 5. So we just kind of, we were like, 5 seems like a good number, right? But I saw some alignment with the Skonal pillars. So something I'm now thinking about is how can I maybe align my 5 steps with that? And if you have thoughts, I'd love to hear them. But if that's also something that you want to think about, fine. I don't want to take up time for other questions either. Thank you.
And Bronwyn, did you have a specific presenter that was for? Was that for Dawn and Ala?
Yes, thank you.
I see that you've shared the guide in the chat. Is it okay if I look at that and get back to you? Perfect, thank you.
And I'll go ahead and ask another question that popped up in the chat. The course you designed, is it open access? And I want to say that this one's also for Dawn and Ala.
Yes, it is. And I'm looking back for the links. We also presented it as part of the Oregon virtual OER conference last week. And so we have all of those materials that are publicly available. And I'll get them for the chat in a minute.
Thank you.
And I see I've got a question. So Tova, I have a complicated relationship with the framework, as you can probably tell. I very much like a lot of the concepts, and what I was trying to critique is not necessarily the concepts themselves of the ideas of what the framework is trying to teach folks, but rather the way in which the language of the framework makes normative certain kinds of relationships. So I don't use the specific language very much of the framework in my teaching. I do use ideas about it or ideas from it, but not, I don't like make it explicit that I'm using the ACRL framework for information literacy to teach people how to do this. I do like the idea of scholarship is conversation, but I think it needs to be a lot more complicated than just saying you need to learn how to speak in a language to participate. And the more and more I think about, I had a question the other day. Somebody asked me, what is information literacy to me? And information literacy to me is actually knowing your positionality in relationship to information, which information is everywhere. So understanding where your positionality is and how you can help folks understand their positionality to that information. So anyway, I don't have any idea if I'm answering your question, but I think what librarians should do is they should engage with it as a critical, as a form of discourse that that should be interrogated and shouldn't be taken just at face value, I guess is what I should say. And I think a lot of the concepts in the information are really good. I think it's the form and the packaging that I often have a lot more of a problem with.
And Kim, I see your hand up. Did you have a comment or question that you would like to add?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been thinking about, I'm the university studies librarian at Portland State, and Anders and Amy are my colleagues, and I've been thinking a lot about scholarship as conversation in light of this new, it's just the BIPOC conversation, and this is also for the Latinx community, and I find that what I struggle with is my knowledge of those communities and how do I, as a librarian, honor their communities, and the best ways that I have found are to learn more about their art and their artists, and also to learn more about their literature. So, and for me, that's a bridge because I don't live their experiences and I don't have their cultural background. So I want to find those bridges. And so art is the bridge for me. Literature is a bridge for me. And I so appreciated the poem at the beginning of your presentation, Anders. So my question to you and to the group is, you know, what are some other bridges? What are these bridges? Because we do want to bring them into the scholarly conversation. These disciplines do have unique of vocabularies and languages. And, you know, that were mainly established by 19th century white male scholars. Yeah, and still the case, the dominant culture. And so, you know, what are some other bridges? I mean, that, you know, what are some ideas in that direction? So I'll stop there. Thanks.
So one of the things I would say, and I've seen this a lot, and I've got a couple other examples, is that one of the things that folks who are doing a lot of this kind of critical writing stuff are talking about is allowing folks to write in their own language and not making it, not being prescriptive in the ways in which language is used and being, that's a really big thing. Like, can we allow students to, like, we celebrate it when it's in a particular form that we feel is good, right? I mean, we celebrate putting Black language into particular novels or other things like that, but we don't allow it in other contexts. And that, to allow that flexibility, I think is something that is another way into it. And it's a thing that, like, April Baker Bell and other folks have talked about for a long time, about sort of changing the language arts classroom at the K through 12 or university level to think about the ways in which using the language in which they are accustomed with all of its traces and all of its is far more authentic than asking them to conform to a language that doesn't reflect their experiences.
Thank you both. I see that Don has put a link in the chat for folks who want to check that out. I'm trying to read Michelle's question. It's a big block. Let me see if I can get there. I'm interested to know if there is interest in using Ilongo as a mechanism to further anti-oppression work in library instruction. I want to just kind of like maybe say yes on that. Shall we pursue this theme throughout the coming year? That's a great question, Michelle. I would like the ideas, suggestions for how to organize this work. Perhaps we can send ideas to Amy, that would be me. Survey Ilongo list for ideas, yes. So, you know, for Ilongo, we're gonna be setting some goals for the year really soon. And once we get into that process, we'll ask for more information from y'all to help set those goals and hopefully communicate a little bit more as we move past this remote instruction back to somewhat of a normalcy, whatever that may mean for us. And I'm excited to see where that takes us this year. And I see a lot of plus ones and yeses in the chat. So that's really positive. So we're coming up on our time today. I want to thank our presenters. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I'd like to thank all of you for joining us. It really makes me smile to see so many people here today learning and participating in this session. And I'd also like to thank all my Ilongo board members for helping to organize this, and especially Bronwyn for your tech support. Great job, love it. Thank you so much. Yes, and as a follow-up, I will be sending out an email with a link to the recording, anything that I can get from our presenters. And so you'll see that from me probably next week. So thank you all. Enjoy the rest of your Friday. Have a good weekend. Have a great day. Bye. Thank you.